Welcome to Global Vision. I'm Colleen Pike, and you're listening to the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. My guest today is Eli Jackson Bear. He is the, not the co-author, but more of the editor?
I'm the editor. I put it together, so it's really just, it's my teacher's talks.
Oh, that's wonderful. The new book is called, Papa G's Wake Up and Roar, and this is the teacher of Eli Jackson Bear. Eli Jackson Bear was born in... Were you born in New York City?
I was in Brooklyn, yeah.
Okay. Want to make sure you were born there.
Yeah.
And you have done a lot of work, including peace work during the Vietnam era. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. We were trying to stop the war, and so we were, that's where I gave my life, actually. And that's why I'm not teaching in some university now. So we shut down the graduate school where I was getting my doctorate, and I never went back.
Wow. Well, I was thinking this morning, thinking about talking with you and interviewing you, and we'll tell you more about Eli Jackson Bear as the conversation goes on. But Vietnam, right now, you can take a bicycle tour of Vietnam, and that kind of blew me away because, when I was in grade school or junior high school, it was this huge war and peace movement. And what do you think about that you can go on vacation now?
Isn't it such good news, that finally we can all come to peace? Because really that's what it's about. And so I look forward to that and everywhere in the world, in Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan, where we can all really meet as brothers and sisters and meet as equals and not as enemies.
Papa G, who is your teacher, also known as H.W.L. Punja, can you tell our audience a little bit about him?
He was a fully realized Satguru, and he was radicalized and changed the spiritual teaching in this world in such a remarkable way. And before Papaji, really nobody had ever heard of satsang, and now satsang is available all over the world. Before Papaji, people hadn't heard the final non-dual teachings, and now through Eckhart Tolle and other people, it's available around the world. And so this is radical. Before Papaji, this teaching just really wasn't available in this country. I mean, Nisargadatta was one, but he really didn't make as large an impact.
My belief is some of the Eastern philosophy is coming to the West to kind of chill us out.
Uh-huh.
That's the layperson's way.
Well,
to say
it's
that.
To wake us up. Mm-hmm. It's really about waking up to who we really are. And in the past, the way it would work is that, you had to spend your whole life doing yoga and doing purifications and doing mantras and doing visualizations and working and purifying and working and purifying. And then at the very end of your life, if you were lucky, you would realize the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And what Papaji did was he said, just because you are of a human life, it's possible for you to wake up right now. And that was his radical transmission.
So we can wake up right now if we work at the gas station, if we are a nurse, if we're...
If you're in a prison, if you're... a dishwasher, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter your circumstances. It doesn't matter what your practice has been. It doesn't matter what your past was. It doesn't matter if you're a good person or a bad person. You can wake up. That's his radical transmission.
We're talking today with Eli Jackson Bear, and this is Global Vision. I'm Colleen Pike, and this is Jefferson Public Radio. The new book is called Wake Up and Roar. It's a collector's edition of the teachings of Papaji, also known as H.W.L. Punja. So what prompted you to edit and collect and write this book?
Well, as soon as I met him, I thought, I've been on a spiritual quest for 18 years. I'd been in very beautiful different traditions. I was in Zen.
Weren't you in a Tibetan monk? I mean, Tibetan monastery?
Well, actually, I helped run a Tibetan center for Kalu Rinpoche.
Okay.
In 1978, when he came to Bolinas, he appointed me the head of his first Dharma center in that area. He had a dream about me or something. And then I was with a Zen Buddhist. I was in a Zen monastery in Japan. I was with Swami Muktananda when he first came to this country in 1974. I spent time with him, and it was quite amazing. So I spent 5 years with my Taoist Chinese teacher. And so I've had a lot of different teachers, and they've all been beautiful. But finally, this amazing possibility for the mind to stop right now, wake up and realize the truth in this moment was so radical. And when I got to him, when I met him, he was all alone. It was just the two of us together. And I thought, my God, the world must know about this. And so I brought my wife back to meet him, which he called her Gangaji, and said, yes, spread this teaching to the world. And then I wrote the book. And I wrote the book actually in 1992. And this is a new collector's edition. It's an anniversary edition that Sounds True has just brought out.
How beautiful. Now, your life has had some recent ups and downs with cancer and that kind of thing.
Yes.
Can you tell our audience whatever you'd like to share about that and what you're learning?
Sure.
Because that's a big deal.
So part of Papaji's radical transmission is that you don't have to be a perfect human being to wake up. Mm-hmm. And I'm a perfect example of that. I'm a flawed person. And
I think we all are.
That's the good news, you see. Because if it's possible for this flawed person, it's possible for all of us. And so I've made mistakes, you know. And one of the mistakes I made was having an affair. And in doing that, I betrayed my wife. I betrayed the person I had the affair with because I couldn't end up marrying her. And it caused enormous pain and suffering. And my life is dedicated to the end of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
This was the most painful experience of my life. I've never experienced pain like this in my entire life. I cried every day for a year. And that crying was really the tip of the iceberg of the despair and the sorrow that I felt over having caused suffering to people that I love the most in the world.
Mm.
And I vowed to carry this in my bones forever. And remarkably enough, I then got cancer and my bones got destroyed. And I will carry it in my bones forever. I have 7 broken vertebrae in my spine that were repaired.
Well, can you vow now to have really healthy bones? You're obviously a very powerful person.
You know, the intensity then was, I think, more powerful than I could muster up now for this, you know.
Wow.
Now it'll take its course. It's really, you know, I came close to dying, and I was willing to die if that's what it takes. Because at that point, it's like, if my dying is what serves the world, I'm very willing to die. And if staying alive is what serves the world, then I'm willing to stay alive.
Hmm.
And it was very close, and I'm here alive, and so I'm back speaking. I'm back passing on my teacher's good news.
Maybe you got something to say. Maybe you have some words to spread,
yes.
You know? And I think, you know, with Bill Clinton and every, you know, leader here and there. I mean, things happen and you know, a lot of people are forgiven and a lot of people are judgmental. And
yes.
I think the point is move on to the most positive outcomes.
Yes, that's it. Now, you know, I'm open for peace and reconciliation with everybody.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody has any issues with me, I would love to just meet with them and see if we can come to some kind of truth and peace and reconciliation.
And what is it about the who cast the first stone?
Well, see, that's it, Colleen, is that I was willing to cast the first stone against other teachers because I felt morally superior for so long. I was celibate for 12 years after meeting my teacher quite spontaneously. I didn't take a vow. I didn't want to be. Just sexuality fell away from me. And it was a relief. It was such a relief. And I was so happy. And yet, I felt morally superior to the teachers who fell.
Hmm.
And I was willing to be part of the mob. And now, that's the karma. It comes back and the mob has come and stoned me. And I realize it from both sides. And I am, it's a humbling. It's a huge humbling.
Hmm.
And in that humbling, you know, I'm no longer willing to throw stones.
Well, thank you.
Although I did recently hear someone say that if you're living in a glass house and you can't get out, by all means, throw a stone.
So that's a very good idea. Well, I want to go back to some of your background here, and I'll just do a little bit of reading here from some of the material from the Leela Foundation. By the way, if you'd like to contact the Leela Foundation, it's www.leela.org. That's Eli Jackson Bear's foundation, leela.org. Eli Jackson Bear is from New York City and born Elliot J. Zeldow, of Brooklyn, and his path began when he was in the pursuit of political and social freedom. In 1965, he was beaten as a nonviolent freedom rider marching in Montgomery, Alabama. In 1968, he found himself in a jail cell with Dick Gregory and 10 others while demonstrating at the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago and during May Days, an attempt to nonviolently stop the government as a way to stop the Vietnam War. He became a federal fugitive. He hid out in the Rocky Mountains, and much is history now, but with that kind of background, do you feel that you were almost called to be a leader of some sort? You know, a leader, a freedom fighter?
You know, I never expected to be a leader, but if it was needed, I would just step up somehow. I've always felt myself to be an inferior, fearful, cowardly kind of guy. I mean, I grew up in a very tough neighborhood, and I was this middle-class Jew, and I would get beat up all the time for killing Christ, and it was this really kind of a horrible situation. And so in that, I knew I was a coward, and I knew I was really incompetent, but I was willing to stand up anyway. And so I ended up finding myself in leadership positions, like in shutting down the university and being on the Central Strike Committee and just standing up when it was needed for some reason. I don't know why. Really, because, you know, I made a vow when I was little not to have children. When I was about 9 years old, I made a vow I didn't want to bring more suffering into the world. I thought I could then give my life to ending the suffering in the world instead of bringing more. Because I knew that I was so unhappy and neurotically messed up that I didn't want to pass that on to my children. And in that, I've discovered true happiness and true fulfillment. And then it's like, then the world are my children in a way.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Can you tell us about the Enneagram? There are some of us, like me, that don't understand it. And you not only teach it, but you have workshops and that kinds of things. Can you give us some idea about the Enneagram?
The Enneagram is a model for understanding the deep structures of ego. It's for finding out who you're not. It's for understanding the false self. So we have a false egoic identity that's built on top of our true self. And when we see through the false self, we can then realize the true self. And our true self is already awake, already alive, already free. Our true self is immortal, intelligent love. That's the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And so to realize that, you have to turn away from what we've identified as ourselves. And what the Enneagram does is give us a map of our false identifications.
Because someone said to me, you're going to know what this is, and I don't. But they said, are you a four? Or, you know, something like that. I went, I don't know.
Yeah.
But those are like personality segments or something?
Well, it's character fixations, and there are 9 different character fixations. And so it's, you know, it's background. The first time I heard the Enneagram was from Gurdjieff, who was teaching in Russia in the turn of the century of early 1900s. And I can explain the cosmic laws of it, and it's the holy law of 3, the holy law of 7, and you put them together, and it's how energy moves. And so it's really about the movement of energy through the psyche. And there are certain places when the energy moves through the psyche that we've identified and said, this is me, this is who I am. And when we're able to then see the pattern and name it and give it a name, you can then disidentify from it. You can say, oh, maybe that's not who I am. What's deeper? What's running that energy? What's underneath it? And so it's all about self-inquiry to find out what's deeper.
Today I'm with Eli Jackson Bear. I'm Colleen Pike, and this is Global Vision, heard here on Jefferson Public Radio. If you'd like to send me an email, the email address is globalvision@jeffnet.org. And Eli's website for more information is www.leela.org. Stay with us as the conversation continues. Welcome back to Global Vision. My conversation today is with Eli Jackson Bear. He's just released a new collector's edition of Papaji, H.W.L. Punja, called Wake Up and Roar. And this is many of the teachings of his teacher. Eli, when you first met Papaji, how did that come about? You didn't like go to India and say, I want to meet him? Or didn't you go there and then you called for your wife to come over?
Well, actually, I went off to search for a final teacher, everyone thought I was crazy, you know. But,
as they do.
Yeah, you know, I was 43 years old. I was, you know, having a pretty successful life. I was happy, you know, I was teaching. Things were going well. My book had been published.
And then they
said it's a midlife crisis, you know.
Mm. One of many.
Right, one of many. I think all of life is a midlife crisis. But anyway, so I took off not knowing who I was going to go to, but I knew I had to find somebody more awake than I was. And my plan was actually to go into Pakistan to find Sufis that knew the Enneagram better than I did, because it's in the Sufi tradition, and also to go to Sikkim, because I had received a transmission from Jagmun Khontrol of the Tibetans, who had a monastery in Sikkim.
Mm.
So to get to both of those places, I first had to go to India. And so I ended up in Delhi. And my first day in Delhi, I was staying at a little inn, and I told the people there that I was looking for Sufis, and they said, oh, well, you know, just down the road is a Sufi village. And so I took a little tempo, a little motor scooter thing down the road, and I ended up in like a 16th century Sufi village just down the outskirts of Delhi. And I went to the shrine of Nizamuddin, who was a Sufi saint that this village was built around. And I went to the, and I prayed for liberation. I prayed for a final teacher. Hmm. And when I left the shrine, I went to eat at the restaurant outside the mosque. And I was waiting to be served, waiting for the man to come take my order. And another man sat down at a table with his back to me. And the waiter came to him first. And being from New York and being in an uptight
kind of... You threw a fit.
It's like, I didn't say anything, but I fumed. It's like, hey, what's going on here? You know, wait on me. And he felt it. And he turned around and he says, I will pay for anything this gentleman would like to order. May I join you for lunch? And
you felt like an idiot?
I felt so good. It's like, oh, sure.
All right.
You know? And it turns out he was a government minister who was only in town for the day. And his sister wrote books on the Sufis, and he knew all the Sufis. And so he gave me a list of the Sufis that he knew, and he drove me back to my place in his little ambassador chauffeured car with little flags on it. And I went around and spent the next few weeks while I was waiting for my visas to come through to visiting the different Sufis. And I met a half a dozen Sufis in the Gangetic Plains in Old Delhi, and the head of the Naqshbandi Sufis. It was an amazing experience.
Mm, it sounds cool.
Yeah, it was really cool, but none of them were my teacher. I went into one courtyard where the Sufi was holding court, and he introduced me to the greatest living poet in Punjabi, I think. Greatest living Punjabi poet. And just like that, you know, wonderful experiences, but not what I was looking for. Mm-hmm. And then he lived in Lucknow, and so he said, come to Lucknow, and I'll give you more names. And so I went to Lucknow, and I knew there was a teacher in Lucknow because I'd read a book that had mentioned his name and that he lived in Lucknow, and that was Punjiji, but didn't have any way of getting in touch with him. Didn't know his name, didn't know anything. So I called back to the States to find Gangaji, actually it was Tony then, my wife, and said, what's the name of this guy? She said, Punja. And I went up onto the roof of my hotel, I prayed for a sign, and I got a sign. I saw two Indian kites. I didn't know there were kites. They looked like garbage floating, like a black piece of paper, red piece of paper, didn't have a tail. And they were floating, and I knew, that's it, that's my sign. That's where he lives, over there. And how do I get over there? I went down and I tried to find a phone book. The P's had been torn out. But somehow...
All the P's had been torn out. Wow.
But then I knew that's where I had to get to. And it turns out there was a Punja listed. One Punja. It turns out it was his daughter. His son's wife was listed in the phone book because she worked for the government. And so I had an address. And then I just made my way through the old marketplace and knocked on the door. And this man answered to the store, his beaming smile, and said, he's waiting for you. Come on in. I said, oh my God, he gave me goosebumps. I was like, oh my God, he's waiting for me. And I go in and he takes me upstairs into this little bedroom, big enough for a bed and a chair. And there he is sitting on his bed. And he has me sit on his bed with him. And he says, why are you here? I said, I'm ready to finally wake up. And he laughed and he hugged me and my mind stopped. My heart opened and I knew I was looking at my own self. There was no question. This is it. I'm at the end. I've finished. I've gotten home. I've made it. And then he took out the Tsinsin Ming, which is a Zen classic of the, actually a Chan Chinese, which is what Zen is, classic, and read to me this non-dual teaching. And because I was, at that point, I would consider myself a Zen person. And so he read to me from Zen language. It was just like, he was willing to meet you wherever you were.
That's what I was thinking, is talk to you in your own language.
Yes.
Or what, something you can grasp.
But I didn't tell him I was Zen. He just knew it. He just picked it up and said, here. And then he wrote it, he signed it and gave it to me. And it was over. I knew. I made it. I'm home. I'm looking at my own self. Myself is looking back at me with pure love, pure vastness, and an enormous silence. And my mind naturally stopped. And it was quite, quite beautiful.
Eli Jackson Bear is my guest. You're listening today to Global Vision, heard here on Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Colleen Pike, and it's good to have you listening. Eli, I'm wondering, how do we stop? I'm going back to remedials because that's where I'm at. The stopping of the mind.
Yes.
That's
I was searching for that for 18 years on my spiritual quest. And I would find that my mind would naturally stop when I was teaching or if I was with clients when I was working as a therapist. But then I'd pick it back up again as soon as I left the teaching or left the client therapist thing. Hmm. And so how do you finally stop the mind? That's what I really wanted. And this is what he naturally transmitted just from his being, that the mind would naturally stop.
I've done some practice in Qigong. And when you do that, and it's a very slow movement and a lot of visualization, I was talking to Ming Tong Gu, who taught here for a long time.
Yes, he has
the
man.
Qi Center. Now he's in Petaluma, I think. I know, Petaluma area. QiCenter.com is your website for that. But I was taking a, you know, two-day workshop or something. Yeah. And we went around the circle, and he says, okay, why are you here? What do you want to get? And I came to me, and I don't, you know, going around the circle is kind of scary talking out loud, unlike radio. So I said, well, I kind of like to stop my mind and find peace. And he just burst out laughing. He said, that's what so many people are, you know, working on their entire lives.
But masters. You don't have to, you can't work on it, see? That's the great joke, is people work on it their entire lives, and it doesn't work.
So it's sort of like, don't think about pink elephants?
Exactly, it's like that. It's really what you, what are you focused on? If you take your attention right now, out of your mind and into your heart, in this instant, what happens? Your mind stops, quite naturally.
I'm still focusing on the interview, though.
Right. And in order to do that, you had to come back up out of your heart and back into your mode of operation.
Right.
But still, your mind can be still even in that.
So we can do our jobs and our commute.
Yes, you can do everything with a quiet mind. It works better. You're actually more attentive to what's happening. If you're so busy talking to yourself, you're missing what's going on around you.
Hmm.
You're not as good a worker. You're not as safe a driver because you're too busy somewhere else.
What I find and what's interesting is there's a lot of talk about living in the moment and, you know, and it's like living in the, am I living in the moment now? I don't know if I'm living in the moment now. Should I have a tuna sandwich for lunch? I don't know. You know, it's like, did I lose the moment? I think I did.
Yes, that's it.
Talk to us about the teachings of Eckhart Tolle and how they relate to the teachings of Papaji.
Well, you know, Eckhart is a beautiful man and he's teaching this about being present in the moment. The trick is to have your mind quiet. And if your mind is quiet, you are in the moment. And what Papaji would say is never go to the past, because the past is the graveyard. Don't go to the future, because the future is already going to be the past. It's already passing through. And don't even stay in the present, because the present's already passed. Because even as you hear these words, they've passed. So if you don't touch the present, the past, or the future, that's where you are.
So you're living in the now.
Okay. If you don't even touch the now, then what's left?
Beingness.
That's right. That's it. That's right. So if you don't touch the now and you don't touch present, past, future, then what's left is this enormous unknown beingness. And that's your nature. That's who you are. And then if that's what you love, more than you love the details, that's where you spend your time. And then the more deeply you spend your time with yourself, the more deeply you realize yourself. And the more deeply you realize yourself, the more deeply you become grounded in that realization. So that it's not something that just passes. Because what happens now is, okay, we have a passing moment, we realize it, and then we come back. But if you stay and deepen, 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 then there's no coming back. Then the world reappears and you're functioning in it, but you know who you are. You don't move from yourself.
Is that how you can avoid is the wrong word, but, you know, not go into fear, for example?
It's really not being afraid of fear. Because if you're willing to be totality, if you're willing to be empty, what problem does emptiness have with fear? Then everything's welcome. There's nothing to avoid. There's nothing to, you don't have to manipulate and control your life. And so when you're willing to surrender the manipulation and control of your life back into your own being, back into beingness, back into emptiness, then love is in charge. Then empty intelligence is in charge. And then everything's welcome. Fear is welcome. Anger is welcome. And then you can live your life as a fulfilled, happy person, not needing anything from the outside.
I think we do, especially as Westerners, I know I'm pretty trained in that direction, chase a lot of stuff.
Yes. Not just Westerners, all animals. See, we're not different from every other animal. And all animals have desires, and desire is quite natural. Desire is like the first baby's cry, is a cry of desire. It's like for breath. And it's that first cry of breathing, of life, of desiring life that keeps us moving, keeps us forward. And so the problem is, though, that we are run by our animal drives of desire. And so we never stop to look to see what is it that's already fulfilled, what's already here and happy, What's already in love?
Today we're talking with Eli Jackson Bear. We're going to go to a break in just a second, but I want to give you the website. That's leela.org, spelled L-E-E-L-A. And the latest book that has been edited and compiled by Eli Jackson Bear is a collector's edition of Papaji, also known as H.W.L. Punja, called Wake Up and Roar. You're listening today to Global Vision on Jefferson Public Radio. And in just a moment, we'll be right back, so stay with us. If you'd like to send me an email with questions or comments, the address is globalvision@jeffnet.org. You're listening to the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Colleen Pike. Stay with us. Welcome back to Global Vision. I'm Colleen Pike. Eli Jackson Bear is here, and we're talking about all kinds of things, including waking up and roaring. How'd you get the title?
Yeah, so it's really, it's the good news of waking up. Actually, I started with a title like The Lion's Roar or something, I don't remember what, but it evolved into Wake Up and Roar. And it's because really it was the good news for the whole world that it's possible everyone can wake up. And it comes from his teaching story of a lion, actually.
Really? And can you tell the story?
Sure. So a washerman goes down, takes his donkeys every day with his loads of wash down to the river to wash the laundry. And one day he sees a hunter who has just killed a lion and skins the lion and leaves. And when the hunter when the washerman shows up, there's a baby lion that was inside. It was still alive. And so the washerman takes the baby home and nurses it and cares for it. And when it gets big enough, he puts it with his donkeys to play. And when the lion gets big enough, he puts laundry on its back. And so the baby lion continues with the donkeys carrying laundry. And one day another lion shows up, a hungry lion, and he sees donkeys eating grass and goes, oh my goodness, there's my meal. But then he can't believe it. He sees another lion eating grass along with the donkeys and goes, oh my God, what's going on here? Jumps out of the brush. All the donkeys run away. The baby lion runs away. And this big lion catches the baby, and the baby lion starts crying, oh, please don't eat me, please don't eat me, let me go back to my brother, the donkeys. He says, you're not a donkey, you're a lion. He says, oh, I am, I'm a donkey, I know I'm a donkey, I carry laundry on my back. He says, no, come here. And he takes him picks him up by the scruff of the neck and takes him down to the river and says, now, look in the river, look at your face and look at mine, and what do you see? He says, they're the same. He says, that's right. Now, open your mouth and roar. And he opens his mouth and he roars. And that's it. That's the essential teaching. You look at me and we're the same. You open your mouth and you roar. You thought you were a donkey. You thought you were carrying washing on your back. You were never a donkey. It was just a trance. You don't kill off the donkey. You don't transform yourself into a lion. You don't become a lion. You've always been a lion. Simply realize the truth, see the truth, and open your mouth and roar. That's where the title comes from. Thanks for reminding me.
That is great. That's great. Wow. I would like to talk about Gangaji, your wife. Now,
yes.
You're over where we left off in the last chapter is you're over in India. And here in the book, we've just opened up Wake Up and Roar, the teachings of Papaji. There's a picture of Papaji,
yes.
Gangaji, and
yes.
You.
Yes.
You guys are looking hot, looking cute.
1990.
That's so fun. So, You called for your wife, Tony, to come over?
Well, what I did was
to India.
Well, he wanted me. He said, look, he's tested me, and I'm ready to carry this transmission. But I knew that my wife was a better person than I was. And I said to him, I said, wait, you know, my wife is the Satguru, not me. He said, oh, very unusual for a family to be like this. Bring her over here. Let me meet her. I said, of course. I said, but you know, my wife is not a yogi. She's a goddess. And I need to find the right place for her to stay. I don't want her to stay in just any place. And he said, well, okay, I want you to see the holy river Ganga before we leave. We can go there together and we can find suitable accommodations for her. And so we took an overnight second-class sleeper to Hardwar on the banks of the Ganga. And we found the place where I could bring Gangaji, Tony at that time, and he said, I'll wait here for you. And I went back to the States, and I took her, and we met him at the banks of the Ganga. And then he called her Ma Gangaji. He said, now, he says, I love my holy river Ganga, and whenever I think of her, I'll think of you.
Wow. And so when she got to India, you guys are so well connected that she was ready for that.
She was ready. She was already my teacher. And when I went back to her, I mean, she received the silence of Papaji through my letters, actually, and then through meeting me. So she was already prepared. And when he met her, within a very short time, he said she has the purity, the nobility, and the sattvic nature to carry this transmission to the West.
Hmm. When did you two meet?
We met in 1975.
So you guys have been together a long time.
Yeah, 30-some-odd years.
And she has the Gangaji Foundation, so it's Gangaji.org?
It is, Gangaji.org.
GANGAJI.org.
Right. Yes.
Okay.
That's from the holy river Ganga, which we call the Ganges in the, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the Ganges is really called the Ganga in India. And Gangaji, G is a sign of respect. Like, I call him Papaji.
So for, you know, the lay person, like maybe me, for example, what about, what are some of the teachings? I know there's the waking up and roar and be with, you know, the beingness of silence, but can you teach us some more of his teachings on the radio?
His teaching is the truth is nothing ever happened. Nothing ever happened. It's all a dream. Everything that appears to be real is not real. What's real is what doesn't come and go. What was never born and never dies. So if you look at what's born and what's die, what dies, well, certainly people, certainly all of life on Earth, certainly Earth itself, certainly the solar system, certainly the universe. The universe was born, the universe will die. None of it's real. What's real is where it comes from, what it arises in, what it's made out of, and what it returns to. And so to realize yourself as that reality is the ultimate teaching.
So we're calling that God? That's what we'd call it?
Call it God, sure. You can give it any name you want, but every name is a mental limitation. But to realize it without giving it a name is to realize your own nature. And you can call it self. You can call it God. You can call it Brahman. You can call it anything you like. But any name will be confining it because it's bigger than any name can name. It's who you are. It's who I am. It's what what makes us alive. It's what animates the form. It's what allows us to speak and allows us to understand and yet can't be spoken and can't be understood.
You and Gangaji do travel and teach, and you're going to Europe sometime in the summer or fall.
Yeah, actually, I leave a week from Friday.
And can you tell us about the teachings that you'll be doing? I have your itinerary here that you can get also on the website leela.org. That's leela.org. So a lot of meetings in Ashland, Oregon, where you are located, and also Arkansas, New York City, Woodstock, and then off to, where are you going?
Europe, Australia.
Wow.
Maui. We do our annual thing on Maui now at a Rinzai Zen mission on the beach in Maui. That's really wonderful. That's every February.
You know, it occurs to me, I'm sitting here going, wow, I bet he's like super popular and I get to talk to him one-on-one. Do you have like a zillion people show up for this stuff?
Well, you know, different locations, there are, big,
big crowds.
Yeah.
So people are hungry for a new answer, huh? Or some kind of guidance.
We're all waking up. You know, the world is waking up and everybody's ready and ready for the next evolutionary leap. It's really an evolutionary leap that, different from any previous evolutionary leap because it takes our own conscious participation so that we're, caterpillar naturally evolves into a butterfly without any conscious thought on its part, we don't evolve unless we make our own conscious choice to. And that's the beauty of this next conscious leap that we're already all engaged in.
So if we have agitation in our lives or we know people that do, maybe it's that fight to not wake up?
Well,
that conflict of something's bigger, but I really like it the way it is, so.
You know, life is suffering is the Buddha's first noble truth. And that's because we are living in a limited form, living in an animal body that is going to get sick and die. And we all have our limitations of the world that we are born into. The limitations of having to survive, of having to get food, having to have shelter, and the limitations of relationship and the conflicts of relationship. All of that is part of the suffering of life.
Hmm.
And it's really the motivation to find something deeper. And when you're really fed up with the suffering, when you really say, okay, it's not getting better. I need to do something else. Everything I've tried hasn't brought me fulfillment. I need to find where true fulfillment is. That's the beginning of the spiritual search.
Hmm.
And so the spiritual search really isn't motivated unless you really have the suffering to want to wake up. Like if you really, no problems, everything's smooth sailing, you're not going to be interested in something else. You're not going to be interested in finding what's real if you think this is already real and satisfying.
Hey, I got a Maserati, I got 5 houses, I got, you know, I'm cool.
Yeah, except my experience, those people generally are more unhappy than the people I meet who are poor.
Or the regular folks or something like that. So when you go, let's say here you are going to Sydney, Australia in November.
Yes.
Who shows up? Sydney and Melbourne. That sounds just like a very fun trip. But who comes to the meeting places?
Australians.
Really?
It's part of our culture. There's a spiritual culture that's happening all over the world. And those are the people who are called. And
mm-hmm. So here you are with your wife, Toni, who comes to the river of the Ganga.
Yes.
And she receives her new name,
yes.
Gangaji, and there you
yes.
are saying, I want to bring my wife here because she teaches me.
Yes.
What happened between those days and
well,
now?
So that what a revolution that was in our relationship. I mean, before that, I was the boss, I was the teacher, she was my assistant, and when I would teach groups, she would sometimes come, but she'd come as the assistant.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything switched, and she was the teacher, and I was her devotee, and I sat at her feet, and I videoed her satsangs, and I, you know, took care of the door, and I did the recordings, and did whatever was required. I was her first devotee.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, revolutionized our relationship for suddenly, you know, I was the one on top, and now she's the one on top.
Mm-hmm.
And so all our power dynamics changed, and then suddenly she started making a living and I wasn't. And so she had the money and I didn't. Everything changed. And it was really powerful. It was really so beautiful in bringing us into a deeper balance.
Hmm. Now, was she willing to step up to the plate? I love little sports analogies that I don't know anything about. But yeah, I mean, at the time she was saying okay.
Well, yeah, she did say okay. She didn't know what it meant. She had no idea. She'd never, you know, when I first... I once fell down at her feet and I kissed her feet and said, this is the Sadguru. And she says, what's a Sadguru? So she didn't have any idea. She was not, and she had no idea what this was going to mean. We didn't, neither one of us did.
Hmm.
It was revolutionary. You know, she was one of the first ones to come to the West with this teaching.
So when you, Eli Jackson Bear, come to the city, whether it's in Australia or Maui or wherever, or in Europe, or, you know, in the States with your wife, Gangaji, how does the teaching go? Do you sit side by side and each
yes,
teach?
Yes, we sit side by side, and it's really like a jazz riff. We play off of each other so that we can just, you know, flow back and forth. And sometimes she'll be running it, sometimes I'll be running it, sometimes she'll show up without me, sometimes I'll show up without her. But usually we're there together, and we work with people. And sometimes she'll do the work, sometimes I will, sometimes together. It's spontaneous. It's free.
And despite the... riffles in the stream that you've experienced, you're together.
Well, we're deeper than we've ever been. And my affair and the horror of that, I had to break up with my lover and with Gangaji. And we'd never, in our 30 years together, she had a break up with me, I had a break up with her. We'd never had that before. It was a major, major thing. And in that then, in coming back together, we had to re-examine our life and look at everything that we had left unsaid or unfinished and bring up all the latent things that hadn't been dealt with over 30 years and clean it out, finish it, so that we could come together at a newer and deeper level. Because we'd always been totally in love on the depths, and we'd always have a very harmonious relationship on the surface. But in between, there was this subconscious war that everybody must know about, everybody has in their
mm-hmm.
life, and these little resentments that things will flare up and you fight about the flare up, but it's really never about the flare up. It's always about something that's been running underneath the flare up that never gets addressed. And so we wrote all that up and addressed it all.
That's pretty cool.
It's great.
I know you went through hell, but hey,
that's
pretty cool.
Yes. And then the thing about going through hell is to know that actually Satsang is alive in hell. That in the midst of hell, in the midst of having the world, you know, doing what they do and being t- totally humiliated, destroyed, emotionally distraught, having caused suffering and having the world hate me for it, there's still satsang and peace in the midst of that. And that's the good news. That satsang is not just here in heaven, it's also here in hell.
So there's hope for us all.
There is.
We're talking today with Eli Jackson Bear, and he's just released a new book called, it's the collector's edition of Wake Up and Roar by the teachings of Papaji, also known as H.W.L. Punja. Papaji, by the way, is spelled Papa like Mama, P-A-P-A-J-I, and you're listening to Global Vision right here on Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Colleen Pike. We're going to take a little break and then come back, kind of do a big wrap-up of the show today. It's great to have you listening always to Jefferson Public Radio and Global Vision. Stay with us. In a moment, we'll be right back. This is Global Vision. I'm Colleen Pike, and you're listening to Jefferson Public Radio. My guest today is Eli Jackson Bear. Eli, how did you get, I know that your wife changed her name to Gangaji. How did you get your name?
Oh, well, my name, I was a federal fugitive, as you said earlier, and so I had a lot of different names, and so I was no longer identified with my name so much. And then I had did a ceremony, a full moon ceremony with a Mescalero Apache, and the name came to me. This is 1973. And it kind of stuck.
You're really living the life, I think, you know?
The X in Jackson Bear is for Malcolm X because of my identification with Malcolm as one of the saints of this country.
Wow. So this is how you spell it, Eli, E-L-I, Jackson, J-A-X-O-N hyphen Bear, like grizzly bear.
Yeah.
Eli Jackson Bear. So I wanted to ask about the book Wake Up and Roar. It comes from Sounds True.
Yes.
And Sounds True is out of Boulder, I believe.
That's right.
How did you connect with those guys? They're heroes of mine.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
So they actually connected with Gangaji, mm-hmm. and they produced Diamond in Your Pocket, which is one of Gangaji's really great books, and I really recommend it to everybody out there. People really love and benefit from Diamond in Your Pocket. And after doing Diamond in Your Pocket, they suggested doing this as an anniversary edition.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
And will you be reading it or having it on CD?
Oh, you know, I'd love to do that. I hadn't...
Well, that's your next project.
I love that as a project.
Yeah. So he's going to read the book, and that'll be a great... And, you know, a lot of people, that sounds funny, but when we have the various forms of media, like let's say I was going to drive from Ashland to San Francisco mm-hmm. or L.A. or something, you know, books on tape.
Yeah.
Very fun, very nice.
Great idea.
Sounds True produces the book Wake Up and Roar, a collector's edition, created by Eli Jackson Bear, and it's the teachings of Papaji, H.W.L. Punja also. So Papaji, how long did he live? How long did you know him?
Oh, how long? I met him in 1990 when he was 80 years old, I believe, and he died in 95, I believe.
So you were able to have a bit of a relationship with him?
Yes, yeah, it was beautiful. I mean, when I first met him, to be there all alone with him, and we go for walks together, and in India, men hold hands, and he has these big, beautiful hands, and I've never held hands with a man before, and I loved it so much, just walking down the street, holding hands with my beloved Papaji.
Wow.
And then we ate our meals together, and his grandchildren would cook for us, and they're the ones who called him Papaji. That's how I figured out to call him that, because I didn't know what to call him when I first met him. I knew that I didn't want to call him by his name Punja, and I didn't. So I started calling him Baba, because that's what I called Swami Muktananda, was Baba. And so he said, fine, call me Baba. And so his first meetings, we were calling him Baba. And then I saw that his grandchildren were calling him Papaji, and I thought, oh, that's perfect. And so we've been calling him Papaji since then.
Now, how did he become a teacher? Was he a realized teacher as he was born, or how did that come about?
No, he had his first samadhi experience when he was 8 years old, and then he started his spiritual search, and He was a Krishna bhakti. He would do Krishna devotions, and he went around India searching for an enlightened teacher and never really found one until he found Ramana Maharshi. And Ramana Maharshi, in 1942, is when he met him. And Ramana Maharshi is one of the great enlightened sages and saints of our world and our time. And when he met him, he woke up and became realized, and that's when he became he started teaching.
So is it is the path of someone speaking, looking for spiritual truth, to go on that quest almost like a Native American vision quest?
Well, you have to be willing to leave everything behind to find the truth. If what you want is the truth, and then the truth leads you, and the search for truth will lead you, and your teacher will call you. It's like when I went to India, I felt like I was an iron filing being drawn to a magnet. It's like I just had to go. I just was pulled. And I left everything behind. I'd sold my house. I'd shut my life down. It was really, okay, this is what's most important. This is what I have to give my life to. It can't be a part-time hobby. You know, if what you want is the truth, well, if you want is your whole life, you have to be willing to give your whole life. And in that, then you realize what's already fulfilled and you find the end.
Wow. Now, right now, you are launching, you're leaving next week to go to Europe, and then you and Gangaji will be meeting up in Australia and Maui and all these different places. Uh-huh. What do you feel like your life's vision is now? You've battled cancer. They use the term battled, but have cancer. So you kind of didn't die, so poof, new lease on life.
New lease on life.
What's going on for you and Gangaji?
Well, I'm still in, I still like chemo. I'm still on chemotherapy. And I don't know how much longer this body has to live, but as long as it has to live, I will be passing on my teacher's transmission. This is what my life has been about. Mm-hmm. It's been about since I met him in 1990, and it's what it will be about in my last breath.
Hmm. But isn't it that you're called to do this in a way?
I guess I'm called.
Or I guess it's the life's work.
It's my life work. It's what I love. It's what fulfills me. It's what fulfills my purpose, is my destiny, my mission. I always felt, I had this mission. That's why I didn't have children, is I had this mission. And I first defined it politically with the civil rights and then with Vietnam, and then now it's spiritual. It's the same mission. Hmm. It's the mission for us to live in peace and harmony in this world, for us to live as brothers and sisters, for us to see each other and love each other without all the false divisions that we make in our minds right now.
Hmm.
And that's been the purpose of my life, and it continues to be, and it will be until I die.
Are you continuing to teach the Enneagram?
I am. I'm going to be teaching it in Hamburg in a couple of weeks. And then Gangaji and I do a silent retreat in Baden-Baden together. We do that every year. And I'll be...
Baden-Baden, southern Germany?
Yeah, it's right on the French border. It's a wonderful, wonderful area.
Hmm.
Great hot springs.
I actually went to that area, Germany, and didn't know that it had hot springs. I missed the hot springs. Totally missed it. But
Baden is Bath.
So I figured that
Baden
out.
Baden is really Bath.
I figured that out when I got
Bath
home.
Bath squared.
Bath squared. So when you're in your silent retreat, obviously it's kind of quiet, but what happens?
Well, we sit in silence and then people ask questions. And asking questions for clarification or deepening realization or for reports, because once you have a realization, you need confirmation. That's one of the functions of the teacher, is to see if you're off or not, and to confirm confirm where you're on. That's the beauty of Papaji, is that he was a confirmation, a full confirmation of what's real and what's true. And so that's silent retreat, is that,
Is it hard to be silent?
It's hard to be noisy. That's where the energy is, and that's where the distractions and the suffering is. That's where the problems are. When you're quiet, it's very simple and easy, and there's no problems, there's no confusion. You're open, you're happy, you're fulfilled,
If you were going to give someone advice, don't know who it is. Advice might be too big of a word, but... speak to someone who's listening right now, and this is kind of a thing they're into, but not completely. What would you say?
It's possible to be happy and fulfilled in this very moment and to never leave that fulfillment. It's possible to realize the truth of yourself in this very moment, no matter what your background or past. All it takes is your desire. You have to really know what you want. we've all been brought up into the conditioned wants and manufactured wants of our culture, wanting more and better and different of everything. But when you realize that that doesn't bring you happiness, when you realize that a bigger car or a better girlfriend or a better house or a better job or more children don't do it, they don't bring you fulfillment, then you turn away from everything you've tried to turn into your heart to find what's already here. And you'll find if you turn in, what's already here is already alive, free, open, and in love. And this is your nature, and this is who you are. And to find yourself is the purpose of life. Otherwise, what we call the purpose of life is to, you know, get a lot of stuff and have kids and pass it on to them, and hopefully they'll get it and they'll be happy.
Tell us about forgiveness.
Forgiveness is so sweet. You know, one of the things that I've discovered in my life, in this whole horror that's happened, is I actually love my enemies. And growing up, I never was interested in loving my enemies. And now as an adult, I never thought it was possible. I thought that was just for saints. But I find even now, I mean, there are people who are attacking me in this moment, and I love them. I only wish the best for them. I only want them to discover their own happiness, to be fulfilled, to have a quiet mind and an open heart. It's all I wish for everybody in this world.
Thank you, Eli Jackson Bear, for talking to us.
Oh, thank you so much, Colleen. I'm so grateful for you for having me on.
Eli Jackson Bear, my guest today, right here on Jefferson Public Radio on Global Vision. If you'd like to contact him and find out more about his schedule, the website is Leela, leela.org. The new book is published by Sounds True out of Boulder, Colorado, called Wake Up and Roar, a collector's edition of the teachings of Papaji. I'm Colleen Pike. Thanks for listening today. If you'd like to send an email or have any questions or comments, the email address is globalvision@jeffnet.org. Have a great week, and thanks for listening again to Global Vision.